Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
Hello and welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we are broadcasting from the International Culinary Center in Soho. And I have to do some full disclosure here. Today, this guest is not only an extraordinary guest, but he is, I think, one of the most influential people in our whole food world. I've witnessed it myself. But in full disclosure, he's a very close friend of mine, and I'm probably his biggest fan. And so today I want to introduce you to Peter Kaminsky.
Hey there, Dorothy.
How are you, Peter?
Great.
Okay, for those of you who might not know Peter, he's not a chef. He's one of the most outstanding cooks you will ever find. He is a mentor to chefs. His background is Renaissance man. The food credentials, you probably know him from his books. Pig Perfect was one of his huge ones. He wrote a fabulous book on losing weight called Culinary Intelligence, which is done, you can lose weight deliciously. But he's probably also incredibly well known because he co-authors with some of the best chefs in the world. Everyone from Daniel Boulud to Michel Richard to Greg Koons. And, you know, intellectually, he gets these chefs and he makes them incredibly accessible. But when I get to the Renaissance man part, he was the outdoors column editor for the New York Times for 20 years. I mean, he wrote about, he knows as much about fly fishing as anyone. And he's a longtime contributor to Food and Wine. But this is the thing that really got me, is he is the creator and the executive producer of the Kennedy Center Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. You know that PBS show that you see at the Kennedy Center when, you know, the Billy Crystals and all of the great comics line up and they roast each other? That was Peter's creation. So this isn't like, you know, a good cook. This guy, I don't know where his brain lives, but he can master anything. And then that was so successful that he cooked up, if I can use that word, the Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, which is held at none other than the White House. So, I mean, we're talking drama here. And it's not like he hobnobs with me. His first honoree was Paul McCartney.
Paul Simon.
Oh. All right. Well, before we get into cooking, why don't you tell them about Bob Dylan? When you asked, you tried to get Bob Dylan to give it an honor to, how quiet
well,
he is.
Like everyone else in the world who's ever tried to get Bob to do something, he does what he wants. He's got a closet full or a mansion full of honors. So there's not much of a story there other than I've tried a bunch of times and gotten close, but never gotten to the altar.
Oh, come on. You told me the story that you didn't think he would take the prize in the White House. That wasn't enough. And so you were going to sweeten the pot. And you, right. So how did you sweeten the pot?
Well, that wasn't me. That was the Librarian of Congress, Jim Billington. For the very first prize, offered it to Bob, and additionally, and I think rightfully, offered him the Poet Laureateship. But
for the country, to be the Poet Laureate of the United States.
And what the hell? I mean, he's been put up for the Nobel Prize by some prominent people. But, you know, in his way, he says, I'm a songwriter, I'm not a poet. I mean, I disagree, but that's how he sees himself. So
he rejected it.
Well, he just didn't feel it was... I don't know what. I don't know. There's no figuring out a genius.
I just think it's so heady that you get to, like, swim with these fishes. I keep having these culinary illusions. But anyway, so, Peter, how did you get to be Peter? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in Kearney, which is a little town just across the Meadowlands from beautiful downtown Soho. Then I grew up in West Orange, New Jersey. Went to school at Princeton. I got a heavy...
Was that hard to get into?
I don't know. You know...
how do you just go to Princeton? I mean, what did your parents do?
My dad has done a lot of things. Jack of all trades. He taught in college. He was a salesman. He sold perfume. He was a carpenter. He had a kiddie show on TV for a while.
What kiddie show?
It was called Pip the Piper. It was on for 4 years on NBC.
Did you like... How old were you when he had that?
I was old enough to be embarrassed that my father was on a kiddie show. instead of prideful. Now I'm prideful about it. So that's me. And so far as college, you know, it wasn't the... You know, this is going back to the early 18th century, I suppose, but it wasn't the... You know, source of great stress that it is these days. I mean, I was a good student.
Did you like school?
I liked school, yeah. I liked school.
Did you do any sports?
I went out for soccer in high school just because, I mean, I played, you know, basketball and baseball and football, you know, my friends, but I went out for the team because, you know, I had schemed that they were going to get a Rhodes Scholarship. You had to have athletics in your background. So they started a soccer team. And so low was the coach's opinion of me that he didn't mind that I smoked on the bench. So I guess my real sport is fly fishing.
So you're at Princeton. Were you comfortable there? Or if you came from Kearney, New Jersey, when you went there, was it full of Ivy League preppy guys? And was it all male at that time?
It was all male, with a co-ed high school, thank God, in town.
A baby snatcher.
Well, you know, I was young as well. It was kind of preppy, yeah. I mean, the first year I was there, it was really preppy. I had no idea what a preppy was until I saw these guys in their father's overcoats and brown shoes and, you know, drinking out of hip flasks. But this was 1965 when I went to college, and it changed, you know, in a heartbeat.
I know, but how did it affect you? Were you intimidated by these preppy? What percentage of the class was that stereotype? Preppy.
Oh, a good amount. I did my best to look like that, you know, before
you
I grew my hair and became a hippie.
Uh-huh.
But no, it was an okay place.
Who was your best friend in college?
I had a couple. My buddy John Taplin, who went on to manage the band and tour manager.
The band. Yeah.
Tour manager for Bob Dylan. He made Mean Streets. He made The Last Waltz. He teaches at USC now. Mark Miller, who's a lawyer in Washington, who still has the same jaundiced view of the world that we all had as youngsters, lives in Georgetown. So yes, I keep up with them. Those are probably my friends of longest standing.
Uh-huh.
Don't know anyone from high school anymore.
So you liked Princeton?
I did. Well, like I said, you know, it happened. You know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll happened in those years. I was a student radical.
What were you like going into Princeton? What were you like coming out of it?
I was just, you know, a studious, fun-loving, you know, teenager going in. Coming out, I was pretty much a hippie, you know. I demonstrated and been in jail, and I had been student body president on sort of a...
You were student body
president?
Yeah,
a left-wing ticket. I ran on... stopping U.S. investment in South Africa and bringing women
into the college.
Yeah, and I'm very proud of the women part of it. I got out. When I was at loose ends, didn't know what to do. I was a cabbie for a while. I went to grad school in anthropology at NYU and, you know, didn't have two quarters. And by this and by that, I ended up at National Lampoon.
So you graduate. You're not sure what you want to
do. How are your parents taking that? Here's my Princeton graduate. Did your father have a set path? Your mother?
No,
like
no.
A doctor?
No,
they would listen. They were not without concerns about my future, but you know, I was a pretty headstrong guy, and you know, they knew I was taking time to find myself. Mm-hmm. It took a while.
So, did you belong to any of those eating clubs at Princeton?
I did for
did
a bit.
Did that affect, you know, did you have culinary in your bloodstream?
Well, I belonged to a club there. Terrific people. I mean, that's why I joined that club. I liked the people there. It did affect my culinary outlook, and that the food was so horrible, I quit after 6 weeks. And so, you know, we cook on a hot plate in my room. And then in my senior year, we sort of had the SDS hippie farm, and I was the chef.
Well, did you have good food growing up?
I did. My mom was a very good cook.
Uh-huh. What kind of food?
Her mother. Oh, well, certainly, you know, Eastern European Jewish food, you know, brisket and smothered chicken and matzo ball soup and blintzes. But, you know, also veal parmesan.
The other American.
Shish kebab. You know, my mom liked to cook.
Uh-huh.
She was a nurse, school nurse, and her mother was, you know, just a fabulous cook. She just came out of her fingertips. She touched food, she knew what to do with it.
Yeah,
I mean, she could make a fried egg and brown butter with a hard roll and a schmear of butter, you know, last in your memory like your greatest meal.
Right.
So I guess grandmothers have some sentiment going for them as well, but I think fondly of her cooking.
So when you went to Princeton, you're kind of disappointed. Missed mom's cooking and grandma's cooking.
Has anyone ever eaten in an institution that had good cooking? I just think the two don't go together.
Well, we're trying to do that with school food in today, but no.
Special case.
Special cases we're trying. So anyway, getting back to National Lampoon. So you... Did they hire you because of your anthropological studies?
No,
did you have such a wicked wit?
No, I actually got hired as a flack writer to write the publisher's letter. You know, they went to advertisers. But after I was there for about 6 months, you know, it was clear that I had, you know, a bent towards the kind of humor that was done there, and I was okay. And I wasn't much of a writer. You know, but I was pretty funny, so I went on to the editorial side. In fact, the late Jerry Sussman, who wrote great characters like Tips and Tails and Burning X, he once said, Kaminsky, you know, or he said, Peter, every writer has an enemy they have to overcome. Yours is the typewriter.
What did you study at Princeton?
History.
Okay, so history, anthropology. So you had to write a bunch of papers there.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let you out unless you were literate.
No, you had a... What's the language parameters on this show?
Hey, it's internet. As I told David Chang, please come on the show. You can say fuck if you want to.
Well, the thing about Princeton is they have a thing called the precept system where you go to one lecture or two lectures and one small discussion group a week. So you really learn, especially if you'd like to have a good time in your college years, you really learn to bullshit about stuff you didn't know. So I became, you know, my talking skills and treading water skills were greatly improved.
I see. So how long were you at the National Lampoon?
About 4 years.
That's a long time.
And whilst there, it was totally, you know, it was as you'd expect. I mean, when I first went there, the radio show was still going, so Belushi and Bill Murray and Gilda and Paul Schaefer were all there.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Chris Guest. And, of course, wonderful, you know, staff of writers and editors, Sean Kelly, John Weidman, who's done many plays with Stephen Sondheim. It was just a wonderful group.
What was your day like?
Show up at the crack of noon, you know. Sit around. There's that word bullshit again. Mm-hmm. Basically, we just made each other laugh, you know, for 28 days and then wrote the book. We'd go to have drinks about 4 or 5 at a place called the Robata on 60th Street. We'd stay there until, you know, we
barely able to. I learned to drink martinis there from that same Jerry Sussman. And that was it. There was
How
a lot.
How did you leave that? That must have been so much fun.
Well,
did they pay you anything? Or did you pay them?
Living wage. It was fun. It was a real boys' club, and, you know, it was a prep school in a way. I mean, it was very competitive. If you didn't have your character armor on that day, you were going to be shredded. And if you did, you try to shred somebody else. So it was hardball. Mm-hmm. And while there, just on a vacation, I discovered fishing, which I'd never done. I didn't grow up, you know, as an outdoorsman. And I just loved it and soon discovered fly fishing. And the bar was kind of low in outdoor writing, so I was able, because I could put two sentences together, you know, I was able to start writing for the magazines and eventually for the Times, which I still do from time to time. And so that became, well, I was a totally stonefly fisherman for a long time. I just loved it. And I always, this is something I picked up from Hemingway, you know, when he would put like a slice of lemon on a plate or a sandwich of onions and apples, you know, in the hills, and I guess for whom the bell tolls, the food would just leap off the page like your own name. You know, it really, food does that on a printed page. So in all my outdoors columns for the Times, I always included food, whether it was a baby Ruth or my mother's rug lock or a brisket sandwich or a steak in Argentina. And some years into that, I was having my annual Christmas lunch with one of my roommates, died recently from Princeton. We would have a Christmas lunch every year. We were having it at 21 Club. And I had done a series in the Times that year called A Season on the Harbor, where every month I fished in a different place in New York City waters. And we have, for those who are not aware of it, I think 568 miles of coastline.
Wow.
And an awful lot of fish. Well, you're from way out in the hinterlands of Brooklyn, so you probably know that from the fishing fleet out there. And for the very last story, I went out with my daughter, Lucy, my older daughter, who must have been, gee whiz, 10, 9 or 10 at the time. We went out on one of those party boats from Sheepshead Bay for blackfish. And it was in December. And we had the luck to be next to the guy who was the walrus keeper at the Coney Island Aquarium and quite a fisherman. So we caught a mess of fish. And Michael LaMonaco, a well-known chef, he was the chef at 21 Club, then later at Windows on the World. I knew him through fishing, had called for some advice once about equipment to get, you know, with his son. And so I called Mike and I said, you know, I got these 12 blackfish. Can I bring them in? You'll make lunch for us. You can sell the rest of them. He said, great. So I did. And Mike made a great lunch. And we met, you know, Frank Gifford and Ethel Kennedy on the coat check line with my little igloo cooler, you know, and my fish. And the Times printed that story. They gave it most of a page with pictures. Mike flipping pans and Eddie catching fish. And I got more response from that one story than everything I'd written in my career up to that point, put together. So a little light bulb went on, and I said, food. So I started to write about food. Kurt Anderson was the editor of New York Magazine at the time, and I had produced some television. And I had the opportunity to write about food. I did a gigantic story.
Okay, let's take a break here. And we're going to come back, and we're going to... That's the next chapter in your story, I think.
Great.
When we're getting really into the food. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is Peter Kaminsky, one of the most respected food writers in America and a great mentor to many chefs. And Peter, let's take it from Gramercy Tavern. How did you get that gig?
Well, my brother and I had a production office. We were doing a lot of comedy shows at that time, specials for HBO, Showtime, some NBC. And we used to eat at Union Square Cafe three times a week. Eat, loosely interpreted, because also a good amount of martinis happened in those years. So I knew Danny Meyer, and when he said he was opening a new place, I said, gee, I'd love to do the making of. And I actually got the assignment from the New Yorker. And it took a year and a half. I went to Italy to see the restaurants that he liked. I went to France to observe the service at Taiwan, which Dan was an admirer of. And I wrote the darn thing, and Tina Brown didn't like it, which happened a lot with stuff that she assigned. And Kurt Anderson had said to me he would kill to get that story. So I called him and said, you don't have to kill. So he put it on the cover, and it made a big splash. And the person, the woman who was writing Underground Gourmet, was leaving that job at the time, and Kurt asked me if I'd like to write that. And for those of you who don't know it, that's sort of, ethnic and entry-level fine dining in New York. And I have always been a proponent of drive-by dining. I like to suss out weird ethnic places in out-of-the-way neighborhoods, and I think it's one of the glories of New York culinary world. In fact, I think it's what contributes to our being such a great food town, mm-hmm. is that we can really sample accurate renditions of the world's cuisines.
So wait, so let me dial back a little bit. So you, I'm not going to say normal kid, but you have a kind of a normal experience of having good food in your home. You went to a college where maybe you had a bit more broader experience with food, and then you're in New York City hanging out at various places. I'm not really finding a track where a palate gets developed other than just a smart person thinking about food, being exposed. And in those days, I'd say the Wild West days of New York City and the coming of age of American restaurateurs and chefs was in the early 80s and late 70s. And so knowing how respected you are and how chefs look to you and, in the books that you write with such clarity on a lot of food issues, where is this development of your palate and your understanding? Is it just pure Peter Kaminsky, or was there one particular person or experience that really started giving you a greater depth in understanding food?
Well, I always cooked. I've always been the cook in the house. That's going back to when I was 19. In fact, I was a short order cook and, a burger flipper, and I worked in a place, in high school that made corned beef sandwiches and knishes. So I've always cooked, and I've always been a little adventuresome with my cooking. I mean, I guess like a lot of people of our generation, I cut my teeth on the joy of cooking, which I think is still a marvelous work. And then Julia kind of showed that if you did it methodically and took the pretense out of it, you could really make accurate, beautiful French dishes, and I made a lot of them. And then I would say Sheila Lukens showed those of us who'd been down that path that there was a whole world out there of culinary traditions that were accessible to us, and she made them very accessible in her recipes. So people like that really helped me along the way. No question that my mother and my grandmother influenced me deeply. I mean, I was making their dishes, for, Black Panther get-togethers. I was making their brisket, in the 60s. So I've always cooked. I'm told by chefs I have an accurate palate. I can taste a lot. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's part of it. You sort of gravitate towards, what.
So when you were doing Underground Gourmet, how are you approaching the food? Socially? Or culinarily? What was the thrust of that? your article?
Culinarily, primarily. Well, listen, restaurant eating is a social act.
Right.
So, you know, and it's you know, a little bit of a stage play. In fact, the first restaurant reviews, you know, by Grimaud de la Reynière in France, he was a theater critic, and he wrote his restaurant reviews as if he were critiquing a play. So, but certainly in the inexpensive places, what you want to write about is how does the food taste, what's unusual about it, what new thing are you going to learn, what are you going to come back for, and then the ambiance.
You're sitting there.
I wanted to say one point, though.
Okay, sorry.
One thing you don't write about, or I never did, which I realized is the service, the tenor in a room makes so much of a difference to how you experience a restaurant. You know, you could tell when you walk by a restaurant, if the people on the floor look bummered, you're not going to have a good time. You can go to a place that has great food and really snooty, lousy service, and it's like ashes in your mouth. And you go to a place that's got mediocre food, really nice people, you're going to go back. So that's part of that social aspect of restaurants.
Right. So I was going to ask you, when you're sitting there, are you sitting thinking as a writer? Because what you described was so structured to me, you know. And I think you need structure to have a column, in a sense. So I'm just curious where your brain goes. Are you reacting to the food, or are you judging? How do you be a restaurant critic?
Well, I get really excited. Like I said, the ethnic stuff really excites me. I don't know. It's just the joy of discovery. So when I would go, well, still I'm not a critic anymore. But when I go to a place that's hit my radar that way, I'm just very excited to see what they've got and why don't I try this and try that. There's always anticipation. You taste things mentally before you taste them physically, you know, when you order them. So it's just a nice discovery experience. I guess it's the same thing people who like antiques rummaging through, you know, old barns.
That's true.
It's just the joy of discovery.
So then you started co-authoring books with chefs. How did that come about? I think I met you when you were doing Danielle's book.
The opening of Danielle, right. The first book I did was with Gray Kunz, who was at that time, you know, certainly one of the top two or three chefs in America, if not the world. Mm-hmm. And we had met at a fly fishing. I was giving some fly fishing instruction. I was with Tom Colicchio at a picnic in the Catskills, and I was giving some casting lessons to people. And Gray was there, and remember, he told me a story about these first mushrooms you'd pick every year just below the snow line. I think they're called Marcellus mushrooms. And I wrote a story about that for New York Observer. And then shortly after that, Gray got his big 4-star review in the Times, and I stopped by to congratulate him. And we started to talk. And we had the idea of doing a cookbook. We called it The Elements of Taste, and it was the recipes organized by tastes, which is a vocabulary that food writers don't really have. That's not a critique of them. I didn't either. Whereas wine writers have too much of a taste vocabulary, you know, they might think. So how do tastes build? How do they accumulate? How do they respond to one another? How do they dominate in a dish? How do they retreat at the end of a taste? Just like wine. So that's the book that Gray and I did. And that was a we book. That was neither Gray's voice nor mine. That was us. Many of the books I've done with prominent chefs like Danielle, like Michelle, like Francis Malman, like Sheila Lukens, I would write it in their voice. And you sort of have to channel them, you know? It's like I call it parody without the jokes. It's got to sound like them. Their husband or wife has to read it and say, I could hear them saying this to me. Mm. And there are many ways to do a cookbook. My approach is, I think you know, you can write cultural stuff. You know, traditionally, these waffles are served in Belgium, on, you know, and that's pretty much, you just go to the internet and get that. It doesn't interest me that much, unless I've been in the little town in Argentina and seen what they've done. You can write culinary stuff. The chef puts this together with that because he feels that this will work and then it'll lead to that taste. And you can write gastronomic stuff, which is not so much the technique or the combination of ingredients, but how you perceive the taste and the experience of eating. And I find a good book has a mix of those, along with personal stories of the chef. Because otherwise, you just could publish a table of ingredients and a method. But I think what people, certainly to this point, want from cookbooks is they want some experience of the person who's writing it. So often, a lot of what I do with these books is just to delve into their past and ask them the weirdest things, you know, what sweater were you wearing at that party, or, you know, what's the name of your neighbor's cat. But often, just like in, you know, psychoanalysis, it'll trigger a very interesting story. Mm-hmm. And that's how you get to put your arms around the person, and then you want them to lead you into the way they look at food and the dishes they're making. So that's just, you know, one man's approach.
So how many chefs have you co-authored with?
I don't know.
How many books have you done?
I don't know. Maybe 25.
Maybe 25. So when people ask you, what do you do? What do you say?
I'm a writer.
Okay, so you define.
And I produce a few television shows.
Okay. So when did you make the leap from cookbooks to really writing culinary books yourself?
Well,
what was the first culinary book?
Well, the first book that semi-literary work that I did was called The Moon Pulled Up an Acre of Bass. And it was about the month of October in Montauk and the great migration of wildlife that goes by there. I was interested in striped bass, but monarch butterflies and whales and dolphins and geese and woodcock. So I wrote about the scene out there, and I cooked a lot. There was a lot of food in that. That's how I got the guides to hang out with me. I would cook for them. I had Pierre Franey's old beach house.
Really?
So I had the best kitchen, you know, between the Nassau County line in England. I've done three works like that. They're just me and my voice. I did that. I did Pig Perfect, Encounters with a Remarkable Swine, which is my search for the perfect ham, which really led into a consideration of pigs and then land management and ecology. And then Culinary Intelligence, which stemmed from my needing to lose a mess of weight and not wanting to give up eating. So I investigated a lot of food issues. And I concluded, among other things, one of the most important things you can do for a healthy diet is to cook.
Yes.
Cook a lot. Or live with somebody who does.
Right. Okay, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, I want to ask you what you think of the food scene today. Where we're going.
So we'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com. Welcome to the Napa Valley, North America's legendary wine and food capital, where the art of living well is defined and each season holds a story waiting to be discovered. Life feels slower here, lived at a place where tables are set with care. Fine wine and food are created from the bounty of our own vineyards and gardens, and relationships with friends and family gathered around the table are somehow sweeter. When planning a trip to the Napa Valley, we invite you to visit the destination's official visitor website, visitnapavalley.com, or stop by Napa County's official visitor information center, located in downtown Napa, where our friendly and knowledgeable community ambassadors can assist you in creating your own legendary Napa Valley experiences. The Visitor Information Center is located at 600 Main Street in Napa and is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, 360 days a year. Your invitation to experience the Napa Valley beckons. Take a deep breath, lose yourself in our quiet green and golden hills, renew your body and spirit, taste our legendary wines and cuisine, and experience the people who make this valley like no other in the world. For more information, go to visitnapavalley.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today's guest is Peter Kaminsky. And Peter is a writer and a producer of TV shows. And in fact, I should point out, he wrote Chef Story, when this was on PBS. He was the writer for Chef Story. We worked together for, I think, about a month putting those shows together.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fun. Anyway, so Peter, you know, I've personally witnessed, we went up to Nova Scotia with a bunch of chefs, and I think Departures Magazine sent you up there to see their reaction to eating, you know, shellfish right out of the ocean there. And what amazed me was not the delicious seafood, because I knew that, but the way the chefs absolutely deferred to you. You were there to observe them and see how they were reacting to the wonderful taste of the lobster and the snow crab that was up there. But I just found them time and again turning around to you and asking questions. They didn't turn to each other. You were like the godfather up there. How do you think that came about?
Well, that's Dorothy speak, and I don't know. I honestly don't think of myself that way. Listen, most chefs don't get out that much. You know, they're chained to the stove. So I know a lot of them. I talk to a lot of them. I'm interested in what they have to say. I don't present myself as the expert. They're the expert. I'm trying to learn what they're expert at and what turns them on and why. And I've done that a lot. I mean, being a journalist or a reasonable journalist, that's the great trick of the trade, to find out what motivates other people and what makes them special.
So I don't want to refer to age here, but you've been an observer for decades now, especially in New York City. You've known all the headliner chefs that have come through in the last 3-4 decades and worked with a lot of them. Where do you think we are today? Is a chef today, our top chefs in today, like they were 20 years ago? What do you see that's going on in the chef scene today?
Well, let's separate, chef as brand and mini industry from restaurants and food. Because that aspect of, so many of these superstar celebrity chefs have many restaurants. They have, lines of prepared food. They have chefware. They design eyeglasses for all I know. So that's an area I really can't speak to. What I can speak to is what they're doing in their restaurants. I can speak to it to a point. As you say, decades in the biz, maybe a little jaded. If I never have a tasting menu again, I won't feel that I've missed anything in life. I kind of try to avoid them. Now, I don't know if that's the temper of our times or that's the temper of my temper. But the places and the kind of food that interests me now is rather simple and direct and powerful taste. I think, which has always been, since this food revolution happened in America in the late 70s and 80s, that's been the American statement. Really powerful, clean flavors, dramatically stated. So, I love a restaurant like Roberta's. I thought when I first went there, what a joint. And then to get this beautiful food, beautifully plated. I mean, not fancy, but beautifully done and such great tastes. I mean, the farm-to-tableness had a whole lot to do with it. I love Il Buco, which is down here in Soho, at both of their restaurants. Again, very Mediterranean, very simple, very straightforward, although the chef, no, he's not. The chef's now at Estella, Ignacio Matos, originally from Uruguay, where he worked for 6 years with Francis Mallmann, who I've done a number of books with. I guess Francis has influenced my outlook on food a lot.
How so?
Well, this is a guy who trained, with Verger, he trained with Olivier, he trained at Inciori. I mean, he was at great three-star places in Europe, and he made a career being a handsome man making fancy French food for rich Argentines. And about 20 years ago, he just got fed up with it, and he decided, I'm only going to cook with fire, I'm only going to cook over wood, and I'm going to use the great things I know about technique and mise en place, and flavor combinations, and I'm going to apply it to just the traditional cuisine of my country, of the Indians, of the Gauchos. So you can be eating off of the greatest china and the most fine linen, and having a real cowboy meal, but so refined in the way the tastes are expressed. And I guess that's the kind of cooking I like the most. So is that my... Dan Barber is a chef like that. Dan, there's not a lot of layers in Dan's food. It's very clear statements of a taste or a flavor. You don't see sauces, really, in Dan Barber's cooking. If you eat chicken, maybe it's with a chicken sauce, but it's all chicken. And that's the kind of food I love.
What you like is a great director who brings out the character without seeing the layer of the director, which is what a chef is. So a lot of our listeners are young chefs out there working in kitchens. I understand that some kitchens play this, while it's going on as they're getting their mise en place ready. What words of advice do you have for young chefs today? For them to be a successful chef, whatever that means.
A chef restaurateur or a chef?
I think just a chef. There's so many chefs today have so many outlets. But, if I love food and I want to be a professional cooker with that, somebody who actually makes food, not just food knowledge, what do you think are some very baseline benchmarks they have to hit?
Actually, and I won't make a dime out of this because the book's probably out of print, but I wrote a book with Danielle Boulud called Letters to a Young Chef.
Yes.
And we had this fictive idea of this person who just graduated culinary school and how that person could enter in a career and what they needed to do. So I think I'm guided a lot by what Danielle told me, which is keep a notebook, show up early. The hours are going to be really long. Now, if you want to be a chef, a lot of it's a survival game. I mean, can you put in the hours and put in the time and do it cheerfully? No. I mean, as Thomas Keller has often said, so much of it's repetition. That as a home chef, maybe you've peeled 100 artichokes in your life. If you're going to be a chef someday, they're going to dump 9 crates, and 1,000 artichokes on you. You're going to get really good really fast. So rather than bridling at the repetition and rote work that you're asked to do, that's what makes a great chef. So it becomes second. All those little acts that people like me and other aspiring home chefs have to think about comes to you naturally as muscle memory and as spiritual memory. Like in every field, it's hard work. Learn to say yes to your boss. It's the only thing you can ever say. Excuses don't. In the heat of battle, an excuse never got anybody anywhere. And service in a restaurant is the heat of battle every night, and it just needs to run like clockwork. No one wants to hear an excuse. They do want to hear, sorry, I'm going to do it better. I guess that's my advice. If you've got, if there's a travel, you're not going to be able to do that your whole life when you get tied down to a restaurant or a family. And so much of what goes on in the food world today comes from people's travels and experiencing other cuisines. Get it out of your system now. I guess those would be the words of advice.
Into
your system.
Okay, 2 quick fire questions. I don't want a lot of reflection. Best thing you ever ate?
It was a poulard poached. Christian Delouvrier made it at L'Espinasse.
And poulard is an older, bigger chicken.
Is it an older, bigger one? I thought it was a younger, smaller one. Maybe it was a poussin.
A poussin,
all right.
I think, is small.
So, at any rate... because you ate a whole one. He made that in a triple consommé. as he called it. It was a stock that was made from 36 hens.
36.
Yeah, 12 at a time. And it was stuffed with basmati rice and truffles, and there was black truffles under the skin. So when you get right down to it, it was a simple dish. It was truffles, rice, and chicken soup.
Really?
But like I was talking about, you know, refining things, it was really great.
So quick fire question number two.
You said it.
Best, no, let me say it again. Quick fire question number two. Something you dream about eating.
Oh, that's hard. Darn. Pizza? Côte de Bœuf? Mean something I've never had?
Yeah, it could be either you never had or you just think, oh, I would love to have that.
Well, Dorothy, you're not paying me, but I'll force you. Lobster just makes me crazy.
Really? Oh my God, it makes my heart sing to hear that.
You know, they're so, you know, they've got so much substance to them, yet they're so sweet. I make them ever since you took me up there every summer, and I adore them.
Yeah. Well, that.
And then I make a stock out of the shells, and then I make a paella with the stock. So, paella gets me going.
You know, I think of an incredibly ripe peach.
Ah, yes.
To me, you know, I remember when I was younger, I used to fast to lose weight, and I remember I fasted for 48 hours. And that really gets you focused on what you miss. And I don't think it's... I fixated on a really luscious ripe peach. Because after you've not eaten, you don't want something heavy. I think there's nothing more... There's nothing better in the world.
Had I had the presence of mind, I might have said that. I won't argue with you on that.
Oh, but I'm right there with the four-shoe lobster. May, we'll have some more four-shoe lobsters. Any other food reflections? I mean, you're so bright. I have a feeling like in that brain there are a lot of other synapses going off that I don't even think to ask you. Is there any statement you want to make about food before we conclude the program?
Well, food is among the most important things in your life, but I think it's also important. May I have take two on that?
Take two.
Food is one of the most important things in your life. On the other hand, it's important not to make it overly important. It can't be the total focus here. People who talk about food a lot are talking about it too much, I think. You know, the making it and the experience, it's like breathing. We don't talk about that a lot. It's just a joy, and you miss it when it's not there.
That's right. I remember, I think we were all good friends with Julia Child, and people would think, does she talk a lot about food? And she didn't. You know, actually, you would always talk when you had one meal about what your next meal was going to be and where it was going to be. And it was always well thought out. But then once you sat down at the meal, she loved to talk about politics, sex, gossip. I mean, it was, you know, the whole dinner experience isn't about dissecting your food and talking. I hate that. I think real food people just really enjoy their company and enjoy their food.
Well, you know, food selfies on Facebook make me nuts. I just don't want to see it. If you're going to, don't do that unless you're going to show me the bowel movement that came from it. I'm just not that interested in what goes in and out of your body.
I think that's a great way to end this program. Peter,
there you go.
I can see the National Lampoon. We've gone full circle.
There you go.
Thanks for coming by.
You
today.
Bet, Dorothy. I love you.
I love you too. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.